Hi there. Can you hear me in the back? No, probably not. Well, when everybody else stops talking, they'll be able to hear me in the back. But it's all right. I'll do the volume anyway. How's that? Okay, good. Hi. All right. Oh, sure, I will. Air New Zealand Flight 6 was scheduled to land in Los Angeles at 25 after. So hopefully it did. And then we'll be back to what passes for normal in our household Friday. But in the meantime, she gets to play in Los Angeles. Okay. I'm not missing anything. What? I'm not jealous, no. No. My favorite niece is meeting her at the airport in L.A. So she gets to spend 24 hours with my favorite niece and go to a play that my niece's fiancé is in tonight. I'm not jealous. Not at all. What? Right. I get to be with you. So how could I be jealous of somebody being in 83 degree LA with my favorite niece? Right. But tomorrow night she gets to come back here, so you can plan on it being below zero for the next 6 weeks. What? Oh, yeah. No, she just, as soon as she left New Zealand, it started to get colder here. So, all right. Okay. You stretch. Okay. You have it? You do? Okay. Yeah? It's kind of what?
Obvious.
Yeah.
I'm not saying at all what he said.
Right.
You know, like, but just those definitions of
like, yeah. The comment is that Bronfenbrenner's describing a setting, and then he's saying that different things happen in different places and with different people, and people behave differently in different settings. And if two people have very different settings and engage with different people in those settings, they're likely to become different as they develop. And all of that seems rather obvious. Let me say the flip thing first, and then I'll say the serious thing. The flip thing is, Bronfenbrenner was a sociologist. Sociology is the science or the art of creating a complex language for telling you what your grandmother already knew. Right? Right. You know that. Yeah. It is obvious. It is obvious that people engage in different activities in different places. It is obvious that if you engage in different kinds of activities and different kinds of relationships, that will have an impact on your development. And if you want to understand why people are different, you need to go back and look at their developmental histories and see what kinds of places they've been in and what kinds of relationships they've been in and what kinds of activities they've done. And then you'll begin to understand how they understand the world. And that's obvious. I'm glad it's obvious. It should be obvious. You've already been brainwashed, so it's okay. The problem is that researchers and people who try to explain development don't know that. They behave as if it's not obvious. Not only is it not obvious to researchers, it's not true to researchers. In part because researchers often don't try to understand how their subjects got to be the way they are. They're just interested in how they behave in those settings. Who cares? We're interested in development. I'm interested in development. And the problem, one of the problems, is that people who are trying to explain problems that people have or behaviors that they engage in don't take the obvious. They do things like say it's because of social class. Social class doesn't tell you anything. It tells you what settings a person might have been in or what kinds of activities a person might have been engaged in. But that's just an index. It's a correlate. It's a social address. If you want to understand how development actually happens, you have to go back and look at the obvious. You have to look at those things that people have done, how they've constructed their understanding of the world, and the settings in which they've done that. And if you want to change people, you want to change people, then it helps if you do the obvious, which is put them in settings where they can relate to people and engage in activities that are going to help them develop a different view of the world and the skills to behave differently in it. And that says something about the process of therapy. It says something about the process of education, about rehabilitation, about corrections, about healthcare. It helps if you have that understanding of those obvious things and don't forget them when you get to trying to actually do something. So I'm glad it's obvious. I hope that for all of you, this stuff will become obvious. We're going to make it more complex, and we're going to begin to apply it to situations to help it become more obvious to you. But that's my goal, for it to become obvious to you. So you'll all become complex thinkers about development. Okay. Thank you. It's more likely to be obvious to a sociology major, because that's the way they think. Some of them. The good ones. Thank you. Okay. You did exercise 2 due today. Thank you. It's down here. Exercise 1, if you didn't pick it up, is on the other table. If you haven't turned in exercise 2, do that after class. That'll be fine. What problems were exposed or became obvious to you as you tried to do exercise 2? Let's take the dyad part first. What questions or problems came up? Or what discoveries did you have? Aha! Okay, so many dyads, how do you pick 2? How did you pick 2?
I honestly have no idea.
Okay, they just came to you. You just closed your eyes, opened your mind, and said, I'll write about these 2. It's a Buddhist way to do it. Just open yourself to the experience. Some people throw darts. Some people pick the people that they least understand. I'm sorry, say again. It's hard to explain power. Mm-hmm. The affect is pretty easy, right? You can do that. Reciprocity, also maybe a little easy, because you're talking about the back and forth and taking alternating roles or complementary roles and switching them. But the power piece was hard. What was hard about it? Mm-hmm. Okay. Especially in dyads that you're in, because yours are probably perfectly balanced. And so it's hard to describe that.
Okay, yeah, it was also going along with the how power was hard thing. But I kept doing that. A lot of the examples I was trying to give about how, like, for example, like in the relationship that I had, whatever, it was imbalanced. I felt when I was trying to explain that, there was more reciprocity than, you know, power. Like an example of like of what the imbalanced power would be, it was more like talking about reciprocity rather than power. Right?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, that when you start trying to get concrete about power, especially in an imbalanced relationship, what you end up talking about is often the lack of reciprocity. And as we said Monday, those two aren't completely mutually exclusive. They tend to be related to each other, particularly when you try to describe the aspects of the relationship that are power or are reciprocity. Other thoughts about that particular topic, the difficulty of being clear about power? One issue that we sometimes have is that many of us have difficulty thinking about power in relationships. There's something un-American about thinking about power. You're not supposed to exercise power, but it's a very important aspect of relationships, which is why Bronfenbrenner has singled it out. It's very important psychologically to understand the influence in a relationship and to understand the changes in power in the relationship that happen with development. But most of us don't spend a lot of time in relationships where there is a large imbalance of power. And we don't tend to think of the difficulty in those relationships as representing power. Interpersonal power is a bit hard to conceptualize, I think. That I've been wrestling with it, and I guess I wrestle with it every semester as we try to get concrete about it. Fortunately, Julie understands it thoroughly, and she will be reading your exercises. Okay. Any other discoveries or challenges in writing Part A? Yes.
Have power through other people.
Yeah. Borrowed power of authority. The example is that mom borrows dad's authority to exercise power because she doesn't really have any of her own, so she has to threaten, she'll tell your father and he'll be upset. Yeah. Did you want to go any farther with that? She just does it all the time. Okay. So she gets her power indirectly. She borrows it. There's a concept in another theory that I'm not going to go there. Okay. About borrowing from other people. Can't resist. Just briefly,
one of the places where power is, the concept of power is useful, is in the notion of roles, which we were talking about on Monday. And in a marital situation, particularly in a traditional household, often the husband's role, father's role, is much more powerful than mother's. Or the power in the two roles is exercised differently. And there's a long history of analysis of families by looking at the power differential between mother and father and the use of the role of the authoritarian or the authority, and typically that's father, to exercise control. That's, and I'm noting that Betty Friedan died this past week on her birthday. If you're going to die, you know, there's a symmetry to that. Betty Friedan wrote about the housewife who had no power except through her husband. She had her husband's power. And the more social status he had, the higher his income, the higher he was in the executive world or whatever world he worked in, through his work and the status that he acquired through his work, she gained social power. Not just power within the family, but she gained social power. So the executive's wife gained her social power in the community because of her connection to the husband's power in the work world. And his income was an index of that. So that's a place where power is borrowed and acquired vicariously. Yes. No, you're absolutely right. I want to make a comment on it, but I wanted to...
I was going to say that I see a lot of shifting power in my household with my family. My father will go away for a couple months, and my family, like my three younger sisters, my mom, we make our whole own like schedule, like the stuff, and he comes back, and he's like in charge of everything, and he's gone, and he thinks he still has all the power in the family, and we get to completely shift how everything works. I'm just kind of thinking about the exercise that I noticed.
Hang on to that one for about half an hour when we get to the notion of microsystem, because I want to come back to that specifically. What I wanted to respond to, what's your name?
Justine's
comment was that there's been a lot of writing about gender the last 20 years that focuses very specifically on the fact that men's power is fairly obvious and often concretely measurable. And that's in part because men write the rules, which are based on our power, or have in the past. And as long as you're in a male-dominated society, men define power. And so men define power in terms of income, the number of employees they manage, or as one feminist scholar friend of mine says, you know, you got your money, you got the size of your prick, you got the number of people you exercise control over, and that's power. And as long as we define it that way, we're living in a male world. And if you're really a feminist, if you really believe that women need to be studied and understood in their own right, then maybe what you need to do is think about other kinds of power. And what's been fun, really fun, in the last decade or two is to look at analyses of the notion of power in relationships, and thinking about why it is that women exercise often a kind of power in other realms, and in part they've not exercised power in the work world because they haven't had it, and we're getting over that slowly, but because the people who've been looking at power haven't been thinking about other aspects of power, we're finally getting there to realize that in fact there are kinds of power which we all have to different degrees, in the same way that we all have financial power or sexual power or how many people I control power. But one of the most important forms of power, particularly to somebody who studies families, is emotional power. And women do the emotional work in the traditional family and are taught from a very early age to exercise the power of understanding relationships, the power of influencing other people in subtle ways, of creating harmony or conflict interpersonally, the power of understanding development and how to develop children and facilitate their development. And the fascinating thing for me has been to watch us gradually, and maybe it's because I live and work in a feminine world. The study of families is a very feminine field. To watch us begin to understand that the kind of power that we have described as sort of obvious and measurable is not the only kind of power there is, and that some of us exercise different kinds of power, and it's not so obvious, it's not so, you described it as more subtle, because it's not so directly measurable. But it is perhaps just as or even more important than the kinds of socially recognized power in control of other people and money and political influence, that sort of thing. I think I know where you're going, and I don't want to dwell on this too much, but when we look at families, and particularly in the second unit, I want to come back to this topic, because as you look at the gender differences in our relationships, and maybe it doesn't have to be gender, it shows up in same-sex relationships too, but one of the topics of interest is how do you influence somebody else? How do you get somebody to take care of you? How do you get somebody to change his or her priorities and engage in activities that will benefit you? That kind of influence is power in a relationship. It's emotional power. If you can get the other person to go out of his or her way to expend energy to do something that will benefit you, that's power. And one of the ways that you do that, as you're suggesting, is to be vulnerable, to play victim, to have a need and to be able to express it. And in most of our reasonably healthy relationships, we're not playing vulnerable, we are vulnerable. We're not playing victim, we do have needs. But traditionally it's been more likely that women would express their needs in a way that would invite somebody to take care of them than men would. Men are taught not to use that kind of power. Men are taught not to have needs, not to need things, not to need anybody to help them. So there's a socialization difference in some settings between how different people are taught to exercise emotional power. Thank you. And add that to your thinking about relations. We'll come back to these topics as we look at dating relationships and parenting relationships. And we're going to come back to the microsystem changes when Dad goes away on business. Okay. Any other discoveries in doing this exercise? How many of you did B? Yes. Again, that points out the overlap between reciprocity and power. I'm not sure that they're that closely linked, but I'm thinking of the situation where the power is balanced, but there's not much in the relationship, there's not much mutual influence, but there could be a lot of reciprocity. And I'm not sure it's easy to come up, or it's challenging to come up with theoretical combinations of power, reciprocity, and affect, and then my mind gets boggled when I try to think of actual examples. Did you have a specific example in mind of a relationship where the reciprocity and power were low? Yeah, so you were creating that other category. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's fun when you get categories like this, because the human mind, at the beginning of puberty, the beginning of adolescence, begins to be able to construct all the possible combinations, and to some extent that's what we're doing. Constructing the possible combinations and then seeing if we can find people to fit them. It's a challenge. It's fun. Then we can make up people who fit the odd combinations, and then we can write short stories about them. Then we can make a movie and get rich. Okay, how many of you tackled Part B? Microsystem. Good. Because I'm reading those. Okay. I'm off the hook again. Was that fun, easy, difficult, challenge? Difficult, how come? But you persisted. Why didn't you give up and do the dyads?
I don't know. It's something like, once you get into it, it's really hard to, I guess it's kind of
a molar activity. Yes, I was hoping you would do that. It became a molar activity. You wanted to carry it through to completion. You wouldn't give up. Yes! Good. Thank you. Who else? It had momentum. It wanted to get completed. Did you think about giving up and doing the dyads? I love it. Great example. Wonderful. And you did microsystems too. That's right. He's not watching. If I knew his name, I could. I know your name.
Alan.
Colin.
Yeah.
Okay. The whole complex?
Well, I was like, the setting as in my dorm building, you know, it's like, I took it as looking at, it's a suite style dorm, there's two room suites and three room suites, so the relationship that form in that setting form in the suites before they form in the whole dorm, it's not like long hallway, so you develop a closer relationship at first, usually with the people you're living with. And our microsystems, my microsystem is sort of revolving around that relationship, because shower
at certain
times, so I have to adapt to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what I wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
Based on there, it's
kind of
interact.
Right. Okay. Good. We'll see. What that task requires is that you pick a setting. That's why you pick the whole complex, because that gets. You can generalize about the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities in almost any setting, but the bigger the setting and the more people are involved, the harder it gets.
My dorm room, like my dorm building, there's only 38 other people that live there.
Yeah.
So
oh, okay.
You know, small.
Right. 38 people only have how many dyadic relationships?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I didn't do
dyadic. 38 factorial or something, 38 squared, I don't know what it is, some figure. But it gets to be very complex very quickly. And in looking at the microsystem, you have the roles, which may be quite extensive. You have the relations, which is all those possible dyads. You have the activities, which may be a vast array. And then to look at the pattern of those, how the roles and relationships and activities relate to each other and how they change, or how they're patterned, structured even over the course of one day, describing that pattern can be incredibly complex. So you end up having to pick and choose which parts of it you want to describe, which is why when it comes down to, well, do you want to do A or do you want to do B, we let Julie do A and I get to do B, because there aren't going to be that many of them. But they'll be more complex to read. I do want to bring us back to microsystem to talk about that, but I want to review roles first and see if there are questions there. So we went through this fairly quickly. A role being a set of activities and relations. I think we illustrated that fairly well. Are there questions about the definition of a role? What might be a role? Do you have a sense of the roles that you play? Sure, male. Yeah. I'm a male. I'm a heterosexual male. That's a subcategory. I'm a old fart, old white guy, professor. If you start describing yourself, all the categories that you fit into, you probably will come up with a fairly large number of roles that you occupy and that you play in different kinds of dyads. So, for example, I am a son, and I play that one out with mom. I am a brother. I play that one out with my sister. I am a father, grandfather. I sent the grandchildren Valentine's this morning. Grandpa loves you. I'm an uncle. My wife is being met by my favorite niece. So that relationship. Each of those is different. The son is not the same as the father, is not the same as the grandfather. Father and grandfather have different expectations and different ways of relating and play those roles in different dyads. I am a professor. I am a psychologist type professor instead of an art professor. So that distinguishes me from people in the art department. On and on and on. Our lives and our activities and the nature of our relationships are defined by, in part by, the expectations of the roles that we fill. The roles that we fill, each role has specific activities and ways of relating and people we relate to in that role. I don't go out and professor with my neighbors. I could, but I learned a long time ago not to do that. You know, they don't really want to stand in the yard and listen to me lecture. They've demonstrated that to me. So I've learned that being a neighbor is a different role than being a professor, and they really shouldn't overlap. Okay. So figure out the roles that you play and the activities and the relationships that go along with each of those roles. Putting you in a role, Bronfenbrenner says, means that you play out those activities and those expectations of relationships, and other people do the complementary things with you. And the roles may define certain things as required in the relationship, certain activities. The roles may have expectations along with them that prevent certain things from happening. You can't do this or that because you are in a particular role. Or you can't do it with people who are in the complementary role. Okay. So they're transactional. The more well-established the role is in the institutional structure of the society, the more likely we are to play it the way it's supposed to be played. Roles have power, and when a role has a great deal of power accorded it, other people are likely to recognize that power and behave in ways that are submissive. They're likely to respect that power. And as I said on Monday, the potential for corruption, exploitation of the power, is there. If there are other roles that support the role, each role is embedded in a system of roles, ones that are directly complementary to it, the other role. But if there are other roles that all are consistent with the original role, then it tends to be more consistently structured. You are sitting there waiting for me to come up with a concrete example of that, which I haven't thought about. But I gave one on Monday. Which one did I give? I remember Monday. I gave the prison one as, particularly as an example of power. But I gave one specifically about supporting roles. What? a watch. I'm sorry. Huh. Did I do that? I think I did, but not in here, not Monday. I'm tuning into what you're referring to. Teaching students, parents.
So if your parents want you to be a grade A student, then...
Right. I gave the one of the teacher and the child student, that if the parent supports the role of the teacher and supports your role of being a student, then you're more likely to carry that one out appropriately. Right? And if the grandparents also support that, and your neighbors and your peers was the other piece for that. Yeah. Remember that one? Yes, I knew I had done that. So if you're embedded in a system of roles that all support a particular role, then you're likely to fill that one the way it's expected to be filled. If they are contradictory or opposing, you're playing the role the way some people want you to play it, then you're in conflict. And you may not carry out the role the way some people would want you to. For example, being torn between, as the example I gave Monday, was anti-intellectual peers on the street or parents who don't support education. It's hard to be a student in that situation. And the bottom line for Bronfenbrenner is that roles are important because part of what your view of the world includes is the way you're supposed to behave in different roles, and the skill to figure that out, and the more experience you have interacting with different roles, the better you will understand them. And the more opportunity you have to play particular roles, a variety of roles, the better able you are to adopt, to assume, to move into new roles and adapt your behavior to fit them appropriately. Now, we moved on to settings. And this is a fairly simple notion, it is obvious. Except that people sometimes get confused. Your social life is not a setting. Your social life is a molar activity. It happens in particular settings. But the setting is a physical place. And Bronfenbrenner is using that term very specifically. It happens in a specific physical place. Okay. So it might be the living rooms of your neighbors, if you want to talk about your neighborhood social life. The living rooms or recreation rooms or kitchens or patios of the people in your neighborhood. But you should be able to pin it down to specific places. And you should be able to define the physical characteristics of those places. And every physical place permits particular kinds of activities and relationships, or encourages particular kinds of relationships, particular kinds of activities. And many activities are not possible. Some kinds of relationships are not possible in particular physical places. And that should be obvious. The challenge is to keep it obvious, keep it in front of your awareness as you're thinking about settings. And if we're going to think about development, then we want to think about the kinds of settings that facilitate development. If a setting doesn't let you engage in a variety of activities, or those activities can't become more complex, or the setting doesn't permit you to engage in a variety of roles or relationships that become more positive, then that setting is not likely to be particularly good for your development, because your development is going to be enhanced when you can engage in a variety of roles, engage in complex activities, engage in activities in relationships that are going to become more complex, and where you get more and more of the power, and that you engage in reciprocal interaction. So you think about the places that you inhabit at different times, and think about the degree to which they encourage development. We'll make that concrete as we go along. And if different settings, for example, well, let's go to education. If a particular school doesn't do a very good job, it's a failing school. Kids don't learn much in it. They don't develop well. And another school does a very good job. Kids get great test scores. They don't have discipline problems. They go on to good colleges. If those settings produce different results developmentally, then we ought to be able to look at the pattern of activities, the roles and the relations that take place in those settings, to find the causes of those differences. Assuming that the people who come into those settings are fairly similar. Okay, we may have to broaden it. But if we're going to say that this preschool is bad and this one is good, or this home produces people who are really well developed and this home doesn't, we ought to be able to see differences in what goes on in those settings that are related to the differences in developmental outcomes. Now, we have activities, relations, roles, and we have settings. People don't stay in the same setting or in the same role all the time. So we're going to add a definition here, which is an ecological transition. An ecological transition happens whenever you change settings or roles or both. So when you enter a new role, when you're given a new role, that's an ecological transition. If you move from one setting to another, that's an ecological transition. And sometimes both are involved. You move to a new setting and have a new role. Okay. So an example, the transition from high school to college is an ecological transition. Change of setting and a change in role, if there's a difference between the role of high school student and college student. Is there? Were the expectations different from high school to college? Yeah. Usually both. Some of you went to high schools that treated you very much like college students, and a lot of us didn't. The expectations were quite different. Yeah. Can you think of other ecological transitions just off the top of your head?
Marriage.
Marriage. You go from being a fiancé to a spouse, and the roles change. high school senior to college freshman.
Having a baby.
Having a baby, going from pregnant to mother. Losing a job or getting a new job, entering a new setting, assuming the job occurs in a setting or that it includes a new role, and often it's both. So you're entering a new setting, that's an ecological transition, you may be taking on a new role or losing a role. Retirement is an ecological transition, you change your role and often lose your setting. When I retire, they throw me out of my office. We've got to change the union contract for that. At Hunter College in New York, in the city university system, when faculty retire, they get to keep their offices for a year. And so they can move out slowly and clean their crap stuff out. The idea that I'll just have to do it some week, it's frightening. If you've been in my office, you know why that's frightening. Back the dumpster up, throw it all in. Another ecological transition? How about being born? The other side of that one. Yeah. Big ecological transition. New setting. New role. Graduating from college? Being admitted to a nursing home. Mm-hmm. Moving into that setting. Moving in general, changing households. Death of a family member often involves a change in role. Losing part of a role. Depends on who dies and whether or not, if it's a parent and you still have one parent left, you're still a child and you still have a parent, but you, the family, and this is more complicated, the family loses one of the roles, and that will bring us to microsystem in a minute, loses one of the people and a series of dyads. Okay, what we're going to do with the notion of ecological transition is, as we get into looking at development, it's going to be important for us to think about all of those transitions that you go through as you go from setting to setting as you grow up, from kindergarten to first grade to middle school to high school to college to graduate school. And those are all transitions. Every time you take on a new role, there's adaptation to make. And the reason that we look at ecological transitions is because we're often seeing the transition times as situations where either people are having problems that they weren't having before, or we're trying to prepare people for a particular transition. So we're thinking about the transition and how to make it developmentally effective, and we'll get into those issues. Underlying that is that all change is potentially stressful. Anytime you enter a new setting, anytime you take on a new role or lose a role, there is potentially stress. Even if it's something that you really want to do, getting married, for example, may be very stressful. Having a baby is incredibly stressful. Buying a new house and moving, very stressful. Building a house for a couple is one of the most stressful things they can do. In fact, if you are involved in the building of it, you know, observing and managing the building yourself while it's going on, it's even more stressful than having a baby. I often advise couples, buy something that's already been built. Don't design and build your own. Don't go through that process unless you are really sure that you can deal with the stress, because it'll destroy relationships. It does. It really does. Whatever the change is potentially stressful, and it requires adaptation. If you move into a new role, you have to figure out the expectations, you have to figure out the new activities, you have to figure out how to do them, you have to become comfortable in that role. And that's a process of development. If you change settings, you have to figure out what's going on in that setting and how to be in it comfortably. Come to college, that's stressful. Have a baby. You're figuring out how to be in this new ecosystem and what's involved in it and how to relate from your new perspective, your new setting, and or your new role. So development is potentially stressful, and the ecological transitions are the times we can predict that there will be stress and there will be a challenge to the way we see the world and our skills of being in it. Okay, we have roles, activities, relations, ecological transitions, and settings. Now we get to the complexity. In every setting, if there are people, there is a microsystem. And in Bronfenbrenner's case, what he means is there's a system of roles, relations, activities, those are the elements of the system that we've looked at, we've defined, we've thought about how they're involved in development, the roles, their complexity and variety, the activities, their complexity and variety, the relations, their complexity and their RAP. Now, how do they relate to each other? And they relate to each other in an organized fashion, so there is a system of them. So anytime we look at a setting, if we're interested in its human ecology, then we look at the pattern of roles, relations, and activities in that setting. And it's called a microsystem, because it's the smallest one that we're going to look at in this framework. We're going to look at bigger systems, but the smallest that we're going to look at, not the smallest we could look at, but the smallest we're going to look at, is the one that is taking place in a particular setting. So every setting, every human setting, every setting with humans in it, has a microsystem in it, because those humans are engaging in roles and relations and activities. A system is components. This is a page out of the book, so don't try to write this down. It's in the book. A system is defined as components that function or operate together. And Bronfenbrenner is taking that notion and saying that what goes on in a particular setting, if you look at the components of roles, relationships, and activities, they function as a whole. And we need to understand them as a whole. We need to understand how they relate to each other. In a system made up of these components, if we think of it systemically as a system, if we change any particular part, we are going to have an impact on all of the other parts. That's how we know something is a system. If we change the way one part of it functions, we alter the way the whole functions. Every setting that has people in it has a microsystem in it, and those microsystems are all unique. If you have different people or different roles or different activities, or the characteristics of the setting are different, remember the physical characteristics of the setting shape the microsystem that is going to take place there. The physical characteristics determine what can happen or is likely to happen in that setting. That means it's shaping the system. It's shaping the activities or the relationships or the roles or all of those. And by doing that, it's determining the pattern of the roles, relationships, and activities in that particular setting. So unless settings are identical and have the same people in them carrying out the same activities and roles, the system, the pattern of roles, relationships, and activities is going to be different. Okay? Comfortable notion? The three or four people who tried to describe it for the exercise engaged the complexity of trying to define that system within the setting and found that it was a daunting task. But it was a molar activity, so they didn't give up on it because it had momentum. I should have asked, how many of you started to do B and gave up and went to A? Okay. Really is a molar activity. All right. So as you describe the pattern, how the roles and relations and activities are shaped and how they function in that particular setting, the challenge is to be articulate about that. What is the pattern? How does it change across the day? How are the roles different when somebody moves in or out? And now I want to come back to your example, which is that there's how many people in this setting, typically?
Six.
Six people. Two parents?
Yep.
Three children?
Four. Well, including me.
Including you. I thought maybe the fourth was the dog. Okay. Okay. Two parents, four kids, grown-up children. And you see a particular pattern happening that's fairly familiar, and it includes the relationship between mom and dad and their power, affect, and reciprocity. You're supposed to fill in the blank when I hesitate. Okay. So they have a particular relationship. And when dad is gone, you think that pattern changes. How does it change?
Well, we don't have the power from my father to influence us, so my mom has to take on all of it and use her power to control, like, my younger sisters mostly, not so much me anymore. Yeah. But, and then when dad comes back, it's adjusting to him being there too. Okay. Again.
Okay, so the power in the system shifts because one of the roles is not being filled. When dad is gone, mom's role changes, and the pattern of activities and relationships shifts as instead of having two parents telling you what to do, which, you know, could be pretty powerful, you only have one, so the possibility of not being supervised very closely increases. So your activities may change. It becomes easier to sneak out in the middle of the night. Maybe. It becomes easier to sneak a boyfriend into the back door, through the back door. Maybe. Okay. The pattern of potential activities... I'm playing. The pattern of potential activities and the pattern of actual activities happens. And you can think about what happens in your own settings, in the microsystems, in those, if somebody comes and goes, what happens. If there's a fairly long period of time when a parent is gone, then the re-entry of that person requires the whole pattern to shift. And the whole set of relations, the whole system of relationships, the activities that go on, and the roles shifts. And the family has to adapt to that. The classic example of that is the father who travels, or the father who is posted overseas, or more recently in Desert Storm, I had my first examples of students here whose mothers were sent to Kuwait. And people were suddenly at home with dad for a year. And for many students, this was a life-changing experience of having to adapt to a microsystem at home with siblings, with a single parent who was a father. And mom was out of touch in Kuwait. And all of the students who had that experience, I talked to five or six, all of those students found that their relationships with their fathers became much closer. They had much more positive affect with their fathers than they had ever had. More joint activities, a lot more reciprocity, and I don't know where to put this in Bronfenbrenner, but a lot, probably under affect, a lot more respect for their fathers, and the relationships changed on the father's end as well, because he became much more aware of and engaged in the pattern of activities that was going on in the system, in the microsystem.
That's the way it became to my mother and I. Like, I wrote about that in for one of my examples, and we have very, very, very positive relationship, and like the power. I don't think it'll ever be an even power, but it's mm-hmm. very, very close together. And I've seen that change, and I think that is primarily because of my father being gone and me being like being the oldest, having to help out with everything and almost take on like another power role myself.
Right. So when there is only one parent, the oldest child takes on a different role. The role shifts. And the older child, particularly the oldest child, is specifically expected to take on a more parental role with siblings, to pitch in more, to be more aware of what's going on in the entire system, to engage in activities that she or he might not engage in if both parents are there. So that's a classic example of the shift in the microsystem, creating changes in the role, creating changes in the activity, changes in the relationships, all of which are beneficial to your development. Because they increase the variety of the roles that you've been in, they increase the power in those relationships. They increase the reciprocity in the role with your mother, in the relationship with your mother, as you share more of that responsibility for younger kids. So it's a wonderful example of how taking one person out creates an opportunity for development, particularly for the oldest child. What happens when he comes back?
Oh, man.
Whoops! De-development?
Well, whenever dad comes home, everyone's like, you gotta ask dad to go do something because he's not used to the system and
right.
He's the one that'll let you go do everything because he doesn't know what's going on.
Right. Okay, so his way of adapting to the change in the system is that he kind of gives up. He lets you do what he wants. He can't deal with it. But the point is that when that person comes back, that person expects the system to be as it was the minute before he left. It is not. So he's coming back into a system that has changed, and he has to figure out what's going on now. And that may be a complex task. And that creates stress in the entire system, Because the entire system has to adapt to having this person back in. And that's why I laughed and said de-development, because when dad comes back in and there are two parent figures there again, the power and responsibility that the oldest child has exercised may not be needed. And that may create conflict between the parent who has come back and wants to take some of that power and exercise his authority. And the eldest may resist that. Nah, she's happy to give it up. Okay, I can go play again. But the whole system gets to readjust because the people in it have changed. Who is in it has changed. Okay? We'll go from there.
I'll email, I'm going to send it as attachment, and I'm going to send it as the body, because okay. I have AppleWorks. So
I can deal with AppleWorks.
You can?
Yeah, because I have a Mac.
I'll send it both ways still, though. Yeah. But I'm Kate, by the way.
Kate
Ryan.
Right, okay.
So I'll send that as soon as I get back.
Great.
Thank you.
Good, thank you. Yes.
Come by today?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Allie,
I gave up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Allie, you're also sick as well.
There should be somebody there till at least 4:30.
4:30, and I don't need to go to you directly for it. I can go to
No, I'll them. Put it out. What's your last name?
Kadumi.
Kadumi, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
See you later.
Hi.
I got a couple of things. I was sick all last week.
I missed you.
Yeah. Thank you. But I have the first assignment
Great.
That I didn't get to hand in. And I've been sort of listening online.
Okay, good. Speaking of which, I can turn that off now.
But also there was a problem with, because I'm a...